Well, the Blades were back in action on Saturday, and while it wasn't exactly a Vindies display, they got the job done against the toothless Terriers of Huddersfield Town. Now the focus turns to a very annoying Monday night show in which Paul Heckenbottom's side travel to take on a Wigan side now managed by a Premier League winner. This is the Star Blades podcast. James, we're back in action at the weekend. James Shield, of course, joining me. I'm Chris Holt. Should get the introductions out of the way there. Yes, we're all back on Saturday there. It was kind of, I think I've probably summed that up quite well, really. United weren't great. Huddersfield, I thought, actually weren't that bad, but never looked like they were going to score in a million years. And that was essentially it, really. I don't know what we're expecting. I think last week we kind of thought anything could happen in these games, you know, because of the break, and we didn't know how teams were going to kind of react to that when they come back. And if we're honest, it was probably about what we expected, you know, still not quite back into the swing of things, but ultimately got the job done in the end.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's what counts, isn't it? We've seen that at the World Cup. France, have they looked like the France side that we know that they can be with, the players they've got? But you know, the World Cup is tournament football, and in a sense, the Championship is very much like that. You do what you have to do to get through games, because it is a marathon. It is a grueling competition. And the most important thing, as you quite rightly said, Chris, was that Sheffield United won that game. There was a danger, and I wrote about this in the paper, and I sort of did fear that this might be an issue. There was a danger that teams could lose focus. There was a danger that teams could lose rhythm. And I think all of those things were true. Sheffield United possibly did lose a little bit of focus and concentration as the game wore on. Sheffield United probably didn't have the sort of, really up and at 'em sort of type style. They didn't display those characteristics at any point in the game, other than probably very, very early on during the fixture. So the most important thing was to get the win. And I thought that was a hugely, hugely important win from Sheffield United, because it goes to show that this squad, we all know they can steamroll opponents. We all know they can overwhelm opponents. It's also gone to show that they can grind out victories as well. I think grinding out, I'm maybe painting a slightly false picture there, because they did deserve to win the game. I don't think there was any doubt about that, but they've shown that they can win in difficult circumstances. And ultimately, that's what football is about. It is about winning. That is if you're serious about winning promotion. So I thought it was a really, really important victory, possibly more important than some of us recognising our pieces, and possibly more important than some sort of people looking in from the outside regarded it as well.
I think probably, I'm no expert on this, but psychologically, given the really poor return following the last international break, had United not got the win on Saturday, that probably could have opened up a few old wounds, really, given that they managed to eventually drag themselves out of that slump that happened whenever they came back the last time. So I think you're right. So I think there's a possibility that come the end of the season, this might be a point where they look back and go, that was, as you say, really, really important, because they could have sloped back into that kind of, I wouldn't say disaster, but they could have fallen back into those the form that they showed in those games after the last time.
No, I think you're absolutely right. I mean, listen, we can't keep on agreeing, can we? Because it makes for a pretty unlively podcast. But yeah, you're absolutely right. I think Sheffield United proved something to themselves in that game, as you've just outlined. I think just as importantly, I think they proved something to the rest of the division as well. You know, they've only lost one of their games leading into the World Cup break. They've won all of the rest. And what that does is, and sometimes I think this is underestimated as well, that helps to sort of keep that aura about this team as well. It helps to restore and sort of replenish that reputation of this being a squad of players that is dangerous, that is going places, that is capable of achieving something. And I always go back to a conversation that we had with George Baldock a couple of months ago. He's, of course, a veteran of Sheffield United's last promotion out of the Championship. And he said there were times during that run when he said we felt we almost knew we'd won the game in the tunnel. We could see the way that the opposition was sort of acting around us. We could see the looks on their faces. We could see sort of the demeanours that they had immediately before kickoff. And that is important too as well, because speaking of, you know, talking about the World Cup, there were times in the group stages when you were looking at some of the big hitters who were probably a little bit undercooked going into the tournament because of the scheduling. And you saw teams who were willing to have a go at them. I'm thinking of that. I mean, they didn't win the game, but that great Canadian performance against Belgium, the game that Saudi Arabia won, of course, against Argentina. Those were teams who were prepared to have a go at big hitters. And I think the more that Sheffield United can ensure that their games follow a familiar pattern where teams aren't quite as willing and as enthusiastic about having a go at them as might otherwise be the case had they gone into this game at Wigan on the back of a defeat or a draw, I think that really does help. I honestly think that's something important as well. If it wasn't, then Liverpool, and obviously it's probably a bad example to give at the moment when you look at some of their results before the World Cup, but if that type of thing wasn't important, they wouldn't have that dirty big great sign, "This is Anfield," stuck up in front of the players' tunnel.
On the game itself, we saw Billy, obviously, starting. That wasn't unsurprising, given that we probably had a fair idea that Ollie McBurnie wouldn't quite be ready to make the match. Illiman and Jai, of course, back in. Again, we kind of felt that he probably would be thrown in there because Paul Heckenbottom had made it abundantly clear that, you know, Sheffield United is his priority, and as soon as he's back in the country, he's putting a shirt on. Those two linked up well together at times, not quite in the same manner as Ndiaye and McBurnie, but still had that little bit about them together that kind of shows that there is a bit of, there are options there and there are depth, and Billy obviously scoring. Not sure whether he would have felt there was a monkey on his back or not, but he's so used to scoring goals, it would have bothered him, certainly.
Absolutely, 100%. I mean, you're right. God, we're going to have to stop saying that, aren't we? I don't think Billy will have been bothered in terms of his confidence that he hadn't scored going into last weekend's game. Because, again, speaking about old conversations, I always remember doing a piece with Billy just after he'd become the Championship's leading goal scorer since the rebrand. It's one of those strange statistics that is great to have, probably means very little and isn't the best sort of accolade that he's had during his career, but nonetheless does go to give you a little bit of an insight into just how good a player he is and has been over the course of his career. And one of the things he said during that conversation was, when I go on a little bit of a barren run, he said, it doesn't particularly bother me because I always know there's a goal going to be coming at some point. And when I score one, and he's true when you look at his goal scoring sort of map, if you like, over the course of his career. He said, when I score one, I know that there's going to be a hell of a lot more that are going to follow. Billy is someone who does tend to score his goals in bursts. Now, it's going to be interesting to see if he can do that now because, and obviously there's events happening off the pitch as we record this that might mean that this isn't possible. But Billy may well not. He's not the first choice anymore. So he might not get that run of games to enable him to do that. Then I think it, you know, possibly Billy does have a sort of psychological challenge to grapple with, to contend with. But you wouldn't back against him overcoming that because he is a phenomenal player. And I don't know what's the adjective for even better than phenomenal. When it comes to finishing, he would tick that box. But it's hugely important as well for Sheffield United that they can keep Billy firing, because I think one of the reasons why Sheffield United are where they are in the table right now, despite all of the issues that they've had to contend with this season and are still contending with, by the way, is that they've not just got one player who's scoring a lot of goals, they've got two. That partnership between Ndiaye and McBurnie is something that is not replicated across the rest of the league. Other teams tend to have maybe one player who's scoring an awful lot of goals and then a couple of others behind just chipping in with the odd one here and there. That isn't the case at Sheffield United, and that has made such a huge difference to their results and the position in the table. It's one of the reasons why, and I'll be talking about this in a column later this week, why I do think Sheffield United should be getting promoted this season. If they can get three players scoring in their team on a regular basis, I think they're going to be almost unstoppable.
And Billy's clearly got that. I mean, knowing Billy, not particularly well, admittedly, but having spoken to him and read what he said and the things there, some people will say, oh, Billy, you know, a player of his age and what he's done in the past will be, you know, be happy to be, you know, coming in and doing the bits and pieces and coming off the bench. Billy's not going to be happy with that, is he? Billy will feel like he is still Sheffield United's best striker, and he'll not be happy to accept that he's not.
If Billy was on this podcast now, and he took a truth drug, an absolute honesty drug, he would tell you that every time Paul Heckingbottom sticks a team sheet up or starting 11, and he isn't in it, he's probably cursing the manager and calling him all the names under the sun behind his back. That is one of the things that makes him the player that he is. He will still, as you said, believe that he is the best striker at that football club. Now, I don't know if Billy's the best striker at that football club anymore, but I actually do think personally, and people, and I understand why they would, can disagree with this, I still actually think he's the best finisher at the football club by some distance, because if it came to the last game, let's sort of imagine this scenario. Sheffield United need a win to confirm promotion against Birmingham City at St Andrews in May, and it's 1-1, and it looks as if they're going to drop into the playoffs. And if you could say, right, there's one chance that is going to fall to anybody in the last second of added time, you would still say, or I certainly would still say, Billy Sharp.
Yeah.
And I think one of the great things about Billy is, and why I still think he's got an awful lot to give, let's have a look at his game and how it's evolved over the past couple of seasons. I think with other players, age would be an issue. And there will come a point over the next couple of seasons when his body just says, I can't do this anymore, and his effectiveness wanes on the pitch. I still think they should keep him off it, by the way. But one of the great things that Billy has shown himself to be superb at is being able to evolve his game. He's a really intelligent footballer, clearly, as well. He's obviously quite honest with himself, because at some point over the past couple of years, he's realised, I haven't got that sort of turn of pace that perhaps I used to have. I can't maybe get into some of the positions that I used to as quickly as I used to be able to. So he's taught himself to arrive in those positions in different ways, to get into those positions earlier without limiting any of his effectiveness. He's a really, really cute and intelligent footballer, and one that I've said as well, and I think this is something that more footballers should have, is he's obviously got an awful lot of self-awareness as well. And I think that's one of the reasons why he can continue to be effective, because he's shown on two or three occasions over the past few years that he can adapt his game, that he's got the ability to be able to do that. So don't write off Billy just yet by any stretch of the imagination.
And as well as that, he's probably let go. I mean, as you say, he's probably still the best finisher, but at the same time, he's probably become a little bit more selfless in that it's not all about the goals. And you see him kind of drifting wide a little bit sometimes onto the flanks. And that's because he knows that his reputation means that there's going to be a defender following him around, because they just don't know what's going to happen next or where he's going to go or what kind of, you know, what kind of run he's going to make, that they just, you know, we've seen it so many times over the years that one minute he's standing kind of shackled by one, maybe even two defenders, and then all of a sudden he's gone and he's stolen a yard. So he ends up pulling defenders across the pitch, which is obviously, you know, going to free up space in the middle. And that's it's a strange thing for somebody so somebody with a reputation so kind of consumed by goals and that and people saying that Billy Sharp scores goals, that's what Billy Sharp does. It's kind of testament to him that he's been happy to kind of loosen that a little bit, and you know, for the team really.
Absolutely. I'm going to say something faintly ridiculous here, and I'm in no way comparing the two players. Absolutely. Before people start screaming at this and sending me ridiculous tweets. But Billy Sharp is almost the Lionel Messi of Sheffield United, because he does have a huge ego. He is capable of doing brilliant things, albeit very different things and not quite as brilliantly as Messi. But the difference between Messi and Ronaldo, in my humble opinion, is that Messi is able to sort of weave that huge ego that he will have into a team environment and be able to make sure that that works in the best way possible for the team as a whole. Because players like him and players like Billy, who has got this reputation that you've spoken about and lives to score goals and will be selfish in the right way, in the way that all professional footballers have to be, but that they're able to keep those traits, not dilute any of them, but marry them into that team environment and make sure that they can still accommodate themselves within a group of 10 other players. I think it's something that's quite special to have. And Billy Sharp has certainly got it. It's something that I think all the greats of the game, at whatever level, be it at World Cup level, be it at Premier League level, be it at Championship level, going all the way down to the Blade Super Draw League or the Meadowall Sunday League, it's the one thing that all of the great players in those divisions have got, is that in their head they will think it's all about them, but they know how to play a team game as well. They know how not to suffocate the other talents in a team, and they recognise the other talents that are in a team as well.
Just on another striker, obviously, Ollie McBurney is having a couple of days in court in Nottingham. Aside from anything else, it's a distraction that the club could do without, generally. And he could do without, really, given the kind of form that he was in. I'm not going to second guess what's going to happen, but should he come through that okay? It kind of seems to be the type of player who won't really let outside things bother him too much. Certainly this kind of slightly newer version of Ollie McBurney, who seems to have been able to cut out the noise a little bit and, you know, maybe settle down a little bit.
Yeah, absolutely. As you've said, it's not, it is a distraction. We're not going to go into I'm not going to go into sort of the legalities of it, but it is a distraction that Sheffield United won't want, because let's be honest, Ollie McBurney should be on the training pitch today with Sheffield United. He should be on the training pitch tomorrow with Sheffield United. He may well not be. Certainly not being on there today. We'll obviously have to see how the trial goes and how long it lasts for. But he should be working out at the moment with the rest of his teammates, and it will affect Sheffield United's preparation for the game. I also suspect as well, and this isn't attaching blame to anybody, it will probably give Colo Touré an idea, a little bit more of a clue about how Sheffield United will probably line up at the DW Stadium on Monday, and therefore some of the tactics and the strategies that they're going to employ.
Moving on then, you mentioned Colo Touré there.
on there, Chris, sorry. Yeah.
No, we were ready. It was a seamless link, actually. We're ready to move on to Monday. Aside from the annoyance of having to actually play on a Monday night in a week before Christmas, This is tricky for Sheffield United because they've essentially got one game to kind of draw their planning from last week. And we're going to think drew 1-1 with Millwall. I think that's what it was. So Paul Heckenbottom doesn't have a lot to go on. Similar to last week, of course, when, you know, new manager coming at Huddersfield as well. It does make things difficult for him, for Paul Heckenbottom, whenever he's doing his planning for this week.
It does. And Colo Torre will be desperate to make a big impression on what's his first home game, of course, in charge of Wigan. It's interesting because Paul has been quite open, quite remarkably open in some ways, about some of the tactics and some of the tricks that he uses to research the opposition before games. I think we can all remember that piece that we published in The Star about how he uses social media to get information on how teams might be lining up. And we were at an event last week speaking to another couple of other managers, and they were saying as well, they can't believe some of the things that rivals inadvertently let slip when their social media teams publish things on some of the platforms that they run, because they said to the trained eye, it can tell you an awful lot. But yeah, Paul, in terms of Colo Torre at Wigan, doesn't have an awful lot of evidence to sort of work with. He doesn't have an awful lot of material to try and predict what might happen. But I think what he'll do is go back and look at the type of player that Colo Torre was. I'm going to stop giving heads up to pieces that we're going to do in The Star, but there's another piece in the pipeline looking at this. I think Brendan Rodgers will clearly be a big influence on Colo when you look at the amount of time that he's played under him during his playing career. When you look about the fact that he joined his coaching staff, obviously up at Celtic, and then moved to Leicester with him as well, albeit not in hugely senior roles. But I think it would be a surprise if Colo hasn't got some of Brendan's traits, but possibly you'll see those develop over the course of time as well, because although Colo has had a lot of time to work with his squad because of the World Cup break on the training pitch, that will have been a real help for him. He's obviously not got a transfer window. He hasn't had a transfer window yet. So he's essentially working with somebody else's squad. But he did make a couple of small changes at Millwall, and obviously got, when you look at Wigan's position in the table, what I think it's fair to say is a good result. He'll be encouraged by that. So there are things that Sheffield United, their coaching staff and their analysts, will be able to use. There are things that they will have to work with. But as you quite rightly said, again, there we go, terrible. This is a really tricky game for them. So it's a really, really tricky game. And of course, they'll go into it knowing what their rivals around them in the table have done as well. And that can bring, I don't think it's not a crushing psychological pressure, but it does bring a different sort of psychological dynamic to a game, if you like.
Yeah, I often wonder whether it's a good thing or a bad thing. I suppose it depends on what.
Yeah.
I mean, we've seen teams who maybe play on a Sunday or a Monday, have seen what's going on around them, and they absolutely dwindle and fall. The fact that people start talking up their... In fact, I think we saw it at United this season. I think there was an opportunity to go top of the league and they lost. That was the Rotherham game, I think, wasn't it? So, yeah, it can work either way, really, couldn't it? You can either be really up for it and think, yes, we can go into Christmas top of the league here, or whatever, or, you know, we think, a wee bit of pressure on us here.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you hear people saying about, oh, well, just concentrate on the game. Managers will sit in front of journalists and spout that line. I don't believe it for a minute, because players don't live. They don't exist in a vacuum. They are aware of what's going on around them. They all have mobile phones pumping scores through to them. So, of course, they know what Burnley will have done. Of course, they know what Blackburn have done. Of course, they know what Reading will have done. It's ridiculous to just say that you're going to lock yourself away, not train for a game, you know, seal your front door up, and then just get teleported to a ground and play the game and not be aware of what results around you are in the table. I think it just depends. It comes down to good preparation and the type of characters that you've got in your team. And fortunately, that's another reason as well why I think I'm backing Sheffield United to do really well this season is because not only have they got some really, really good players, they've got some really, really strong personalities within that group as well.
Just a couple of things before we wrap things up. We are heading towards our favourite time of the year, the January transfer window. You'll be speaking to Paul a little bit later on today, which I'm sure from now on in, he's going to be, his press conferences are going to be, I wouldn't say dominated, but certainly a large part of them will concern transfers. Probably both in and out at Sheffield United this year, potentially. What's your thinking around the chance of there being any kind of business?
Well, I think you've touched on something there. If everything remains as it is now, then personally, I think Sheffield United are going to be looking at quite a quiet transfer window. And I certainly think there's people at the football club in the football department that are working on the basis that there might not be any new arrivals. So if Paul does want to strengthen his squad, if he is looking at things, and I think there are areas where it can be improved, there always are, then the way that he'll be able to do that, the way he'll be able to do some of the work, if everything remains the same, because financially a lot can change over the next couple of weeks as well, then he may well have to wheel and deal a little bit to generate some of that room on the wage bill, to generate some of the room to enable him to do that on the budget. I think where it gets quite awkward for Paul and his staff, though, if they want to do that, is that for all the fact there are issues that still need to be addressed within the squad, that squad is clearly functioning really well at the moment. There's some big players to come back. I think the fact they're second in the table at the moment with so many sort of key performers and so many influential performers yet to come back into the starting 11 is really good. I think that's really encouraging to see. But they won't want to break up that dynamic that they've got behind the scenes as well. They won't want to alter the balance too much. So I think in a strange sort of way, even though I'm thinking this, I don't expect Sheffield United to be sort of caught up in a blur of activity when the window reopens. But I think it's interesting. I think this is why it might be quite a tough window, in a sense, for Paul and his coaching staff, because I think they're going to have some almost quite unusual decisions for a team at the top of the table to make.
Do you think they look at other teams as well? I don't know. This just came to me. I don't know whether you know the answer either. But do you think if suddenly the window opens and Burnley pull out a checkbook, or Blackburn open up a checkbook and suddenly start throwing money at the squad to try and get up? Does that change the dynamic, and does that change Sheffield United's plans, do you think?
Well, I think it does in a sense. It doesn't change what's possible to do, because what happens at Turf Moor, of course, doesn't change Sheffield United's budget. It's not going to change the amount of money that Paul Heckingbottom has been given to remodel his squad. But I think what it does is it gives a manager, because, and this is the case at every single football club, this isn't a criticism of Sheffield United, at every single football club in the country, or certainly in professional football, there's this battle going on. It's a battle of wills between a manager and a head coach, or whatever other sort of job title they've got, and the board, the owner, the person who controls the budget and ultimately provides that budget. And it is. They're constantly clashing. They're constantly sort of battling for influence. I don't know a manager in the country who has the perfect squad. I know hundreds who are one player away from having it constantly, even when that player comes in. So that gives you a little clue into what that relationship is like. I think where it does change things slightly is it does give Paul Heckingbottom, say, more weight to go to Sheffield United's board. It does give him another tool to use.
Yeah. So if there's something in the balance, he can go to him and say, well, they've got a player that we feel is going to push them, that we need to kind of...
Absolutely. That's where I think it can make a difference. But ultimately, it's about transfer windows are about what's possible financially, aren't they? Or they should be.
Yeah. Just one final thing. We didn't ask for any questions, but Chris Borden has got in touch to say, is the takeover dead and buried? It's all gone quiet. Obviously, we had a whole flurry of news and gossip and rumour and all sorts about Henry Murray's potentially showing interest in becoming part of Sheffield United, whether that be as a takeover or an investor or whatever it was that he wanted to do. From what I can gather, he failed to provide proof of funds. Is that where we ended up with
you? Failed to convince and pass some of the checks and balances that the EFL asked for. I think it's fair to say that is dead and buried. I mean,
dead and buried.
there is obviously a chance that he could come back to the table, but seeing as the football club have obviously taken legal action against him, I think they're going to have to sit down in a room and clearly make up, if you
presumably then, but given the unlikely nature of that one being resurrected, we just have to assume that Sheffield United are still open to a potential takeover or investment.
I think that's fair to say, because the very fact that they entertained Mr. Maurice for so long and privately as well were prepared to talk about the fact that this potential takeover had been proposed and was going through sort of the EFL's processes, I think the very fact that they went so far down the line with it tells you that they would consider any serious offers. I think the fact that the manner in which we've just talked about what might happen or what might not happen during the transfer window, I think that tells us that Sheffield United are a football club who, providing it was on the right terms, would welcome, even if it wasn't a takeover, some investment in the football club. I don't think there's any great secret there. So some things like that may well materialise, but again, as things stand, and things can quickly change in football, I don't see anything going forward, Chris, with the Maurice deal.
That's great, James. Thanks a lot for that. We will be back next week. Obviously, they play Monday night, so we'll be back probably Tuesday to talk our way through what is hopefully another 3 points for Sheffield United at Wigan. Thanks, everybody, for listening. You can keep up with everything Sheffield United related at thestar.co.uk/football, and we'll see you next week.